Okay. Well, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31. We don't have a lecture exam next week, but we do have practical exams. So make sure you're looking at all your practical exams. And I think the last unit is Lab 10 for the practical exam, which is a heart. So that's what we're doing this week in lab. Heart dissection. So make sure that you bring yourself with hard shoes, hand protection and eye protection, so that we can do a dissection. And if you want to bring a mask, that's even better. Or a mask with that little visor above it, that's even better yet. And those things fold really nice and flat. Okay. Some people wanted to go and use the mock practicum for sheep brain and eyeball, and they couldn't get it to work. That was on a site I built over at Long Beach City College, like, I don't know, 10 or 15, maybe 20 years ago. And the only browser that supports those the mock practicum, you know, the slideshow mode, is Internet Explorer, because none of these new internet browsers will work. Like Chrome won't work, and Firefox, and Netscape worked really well, but who knows what happened to Netscape? Anybody ever hear of Netscape? Okay, that was a competitor to Internet Explorer way back when. That is no longer around. Okay, so we were talking about the eye last time, right? So as a matter of fact, here's the quiz for the eye. Maybe I'll just kind of slide it right over here. Make sure you know the three main layers, sclera, choroid, and retina. Which layer contains photoreceptor cells? Yeah, it's a retina. And how many different kinds of photoreceptor cells are there? There are two, rods and cones. What's the big difference? How come you got two? What's the big deal? Which ones? Okay, go ahead, tell me again. I'll see if I can hear you. One is for color. Which one's for color? Cones. Okay, so that's good. Color's good. What else are the cones good for?
Detail,
fine resolution. So those are the best cells, right? So you have your extrinsic eye muscles that position the eyeball so light comes in through the cornea, through the iris, through the lens, through this posterior segment, so that it hits right here at the macula lutea. That has the highest concentration or the highest density of cone cells. All right, as you move away from that very center of your best vision, which is the very centers of fovea centralis, only cone cells, macula lutea has some rod cells, but still not very many. But as you move away to the periphery, then cone cells kind of give way to rod cells. And what's the advantage of having rod cells if your best vision is with cone cells? You can see in dim light conditions, but in dim light, you can't see color, you can't see fine detail. So we call that a trade-off, right? There is always a trade-off in an engineering sense. Okay, so if you want a really speedy vehicle, what kind of vehicle do you want? Like something small, right? Something that's fast, something small. But if you want to carry a lot of stuff with you, how about a small vehicle? Doesn't work. And then it can't be speedy, so then you need a big truck, right? So there's always trade-offs that people make, right? Including how your body has evolved. There are trade-offs. All right, there's a blind spot in the retina called the optic disc, right? And so I think we talked about all these things about the eyeball, and we're about ready to move into the auditory system, which is hearing. All right, so the auditory system, in terms of its anatomy, the ear can be broken down into three main regions. And the three main regions are external ear, middle ear, and internal ear. The internal ear sometimes we call the labyrinth because there's like a bony shell, almost like an eggshell, that surrounds these sensory organs inside the temporal bone. And in particular, it's the petrous region of the temporal bone that holds the labyrinth or the inner ear. All right, so let's define these things in a little bit more detail. The external ear starts at the pinna, right? And this is the helix of the pinna. Here's a little ear lobe down over here. This helps funnel sound energy into the external acoustic meatus, which then enters the temporal bone, right? You had to know external acoustic meatus or auditory meatus. And the auricle, right, also has some cartilage that you can see with this blue material, nice elastic cartilage. And then sound energy bumps into the tympanic membrane. So that's the end part That's the end point of the external ear. So external ear starts at the auricle and then goes to the tympanic membrane. Tympanic membrane over to the oval window right here is the extent of the middle ear. And the middle ear has a bunch of bones in it, three bones, the malleus, incus, and stapes. And these transmit sound vibrations to the labyrinth, or the middle, or the inner part of the ear. All right, so sound energy vibrates the tympanic membrane. Even very soft sounds can vibrate the tympanic membrane. So the pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane should be exactly the same, so that it can vibrate back and forth. So here is a little tube that makes sure that the middle ear has equal pressure compared to atmospheric pressure, and we call this the eustachian tube. We also call that the auditory tube. We also call it the pharyngotympanic tube, all right, for reasons that you don't know yet, but it goes from the pharynx, all right, to the tympanic membrane. There might be somebody in here that knows what the pharynx is, but it's going to take probably a couple lectures to talk about the pharynx. But does anybody know what the common name for pharynx is? It is your throat. The pharynx and your throat are the same thing. So when you have a sore throat, guess what you have? You have a pharyngitis. Okay, a pharyngitis. It's your throat. So that's why sometimes when people need to equalize pressure in their ears, they kind of hold their nose, and what do? Pressurize their oral cavity or throat, and that squirts a little air up into this middle ear, and it helps equalize the pressure so that you can hear once again. This chamber sometimes is prone to infection, especially with little kids, right? And that disturbs their hearing, kind of makes them a little bit ornery because it might irritate the tympanic membrane. Especially if they drive up in the mountains someplace or get on an airplane, because if there's an infection in this compartment, they can't equalize the pressure, and then this membrane starts to get pushed to one side or the other, feels like it's going to rip, and it feels really bad when that happens. Okay, and that condition is called otitis media. That's an infection of the middle ear, right? Otitis, that's an inflammation of the ear, like oto means ear. Itis is inflammation. Media is what? The middle part of the ear right here. All right, and then the inner ear right here has three important sections to it. And what I didn't start out with in lecture is, we're talking about senses in this chapter, but what kind of senses? Special senses, right? So not general senses, not senses that sensation you have all over your body, but special. Just one, maybe two locations, right? Okay, so there are three special senses involved with the labyrinth right here. This thing that looks like a snail is important for hearing. That's number one. Number two is involved with the vestibule right here, and this is for linear acceleration. Sometimes we call that static equilibrium. And gravity acts like an acceleration force on us. It's pulling us down to the center of the earth all the time, right? And so that linear acceleration gives us a sense of body position. If we're standing up straight or lying down, right, then this right here can tell us what our head position is. That's the vestibule. And then we see these semicircular canals. On this diagram, we can only see three, but how many planes are there that can characterize space? How many planes did you learn? Three planes. What were the three planes? Okay, but I mean they're anatomic names. Okay, I'll have to ask you. I was going for extra credit, but okay. What plane is this? Good, thank you. Transverse. What plane is this? This is? Sagittal. Is that different than transverse? Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we got transverse, sagittal, and what's the third one? Like this. Oblique. Okay, but these are perpendicular. So three perpendicular planes, which one is this? This is coronal, sometimes called frontal. So these three planes, okay, will completely define our physical dimensions in terms of space, right? So just like if you wanted to know where I was sitting, if you're going to describe to somebody where I was sitting, how many numbers would you have to tell them? Just three, right? How far from the floor? How far from that wall? Right, and how far from the front of the room, and then you know exactly where I am, right? So numbers in those three planes would do it. All right, so the point I'm trying to make right here is that there really aren't two semicircular canals. There should be three, okay? And indeed, there are three. And the organ for this particular sense is in this little bulge at the base of a semicircular canal. Sometimes that's called an ampule because it reminded somebody of a little glass vial that fluid is contained in, right? And so that's the ampule of the semicircular canals. Now, the semicircular canals are what part of the ear, of the three main regions? Yeah, it's in part of the labyrinth, or inner ear. Okay, and the auditory ossicles are in which part? The middle, right? Right there. So make sure you know which compartment each one of these things are in. All right, so where are we right here? Oh yeah, there's some muscles. I can see some muscles that are attached to these auditory ossicles. Maybe on this slide I can see it. Oh no, this is just that one. All right, like the tensor tympani right here. There's also a little stapedius muscle right here. So if you're in a really loud environment, these muscles contract and dampen these vibrations so that those sound pressure waves don't get into the cochlea and damage the cochlea. But nonetheless, high-intensity sound still can damage the cochlea because these muscles right here can't completely dampen those sound vibrations out. And you're probably used to these muscles all the time because what's it like when you get in your car first thing in the morning? You turn the engine on, and what do you notice right away? The radio is on to ear-shattering levels, right? And then you can always blame your wild nephew that was using the car last night, but probably it was what? It was probably you. And as the sound gets louder in your car, these muscles contract, so you can't hear as well, so what do you do to the little push button on your stereo? You turn it up, okay? And then these muscles contract a little bit more. What do you do to the volume control on your radio in your car? Yeah, you turn it up some more, right? So you keep turning it up, and then finally, you find a place where you can listen to everything, right? And then first thing in the morning, when these muscles aren't contracted, the stereo is just way, way, way too loud. All right, so the first of these sense organs, okay, is the cochlea right here. And it kind of looks like a snail. So sound enters the cochlea because here's that stapes muscle. It's vibrating on the oval window, and you should look at what the footprint of the stapes makes on the vestibule, and you should see that it looks like an oval shape. So sound pressure enters, and it rolls around in through here, and then it rolls out through the round window. So that's real important because if a lot of sound energy went into the cochlea and it didn't have a way to escape, then all of these little fine structures of the cochlea would have to absorb that energy, and it's just way too high intensity, and it would just shatter the cochlea if that were to happen. So the round window lets that energy escape. All right, so we call this the cochlear duct inside the cochlea, and there's some structures inside the cochlea. All right, let's see what we look like right here. So here is just one of the tubes. So there's three tubes. The oval window is connected to the scala vestibuli right here. It contains a fluid, sort of like plasma. It's called perilymph. And sound enters this region right here, and then it moves across through the cochlear duct. So here is part of the cochlea that we see inside the temporal bone. And then this right here is the organ for hearing. All right, so name the part of the labyrinth that's important for hearing, the bony labyrinth that's important for hearing. We had the vestibule, semicircular canals, and cochlea. Which one is it? Yeah, it's a cochlea, the one that looks like a snail. So this thing vibrates back and forth, and then sound energy enters the scala tympani right here, and then it runs out of the ear. How does it escape the cochlea? The round window, right? So that's connected up to the round window. So this, we want to pay attention to this. This is the organ of Corti. So the organ responsible for hearing, the special sense of hearing, is the organ of Corti. And let's zoom in. So sound is going to go across. It's going to vibrate this membrane that we call the tectoral membrane. The tectoral membrane vibrates back and forth, and then here are some cells that are attached to it. And so these are what we call hair cells because on the apical surface of these cells, these are receptor cells for hearing. we have some cilia that poke up and attach to the tectorial membrane. And when the tectorial membrane vibrates, it changes the electrical property of these cells because it bends these stereocilia. And that sends different electrical information to the brain, which goes to our auditory cortex. Anybody remember where the auditory cortex was? Right? In order for you to perceive reality, action potentials have to reach the cerebral cortex. And in particular, you know what? Four lobes. One, two, three, four. Four main lobes of the cerebrum. And you should probably know which of those four lobes is important for motor control. And the other three are important for sensory. And in particular, which one is important for hearing? And the temporal lobe is important for hearing. That's where these action potentials go. All right, so it's not that an action potential carries sound information, but it goes to the temporal lobe, and that's where you have the perception of sound in the temporal lobe. So these are the receptor cells. What are the names of the receptor cells for hearing? It's a strange name. You don't want to say it, but guess what? I'm going to make you say it before we can go home. What is the name of the receptor cells responsible for hearing? It's the hair cells. Yeah, I know, it's just so strange. Not because they have hair growing out of them, but because they have these stereocilia, or these cilia that attach to this tectorial membrane right here. Oh, let me take a look at this slide. Okay. All right, so why does it look like a snail? Maybe this slide right here will show this partially. Okay. And what the cochlea really is a piano. Okay, think of a piano. What can you tell me about a piano? It's got a bunch of strings. Are the strings all the same length and size? Some are really long and thick, some are really thin and short. Okay, so that when they're excited by some kind of pressure, how do they vibrate? Does a short one vibrate at the same frequency as a big, long, thick one? No, they're different, right? So big, long, thick ones vibrate at a low frequency. The really thin, short ones vibrate at a high frequency. So if you hit keys on one side of the piano, it plays a high frequency. If you hit keys on the other side, it plays a low frequency. And that's exactly what this cochlea is doing. It's a piano. Out over here, near the tip, we call this the helicotrema. This is actually the thickest part of the cochlea. It looks thin, but it's thick in the dimension that we're looking at. So going in and out of the picture, it's really thick. So these vibrate at low frequencies. Over here, close to the oval and round window, these vibrate at high frequencies. So that when sound energy enters, it crosses over the cochlear duct right in that particular location that corresponds to that frequency of energy that enters, right? So this would be like a mid-range frequency crossing over right here, hitting like some middle keys on the piano, which then sends signals to the temporal lobe. Okay, so then my question would be, how come the cochlea is all curled up? How come it's just not straight like a piano? Okay. Well, if it was just straight like a piano, where would these cochlea be? They'd be sticking out your ears. Not just on one side, but the other side. You'd have these pianos sticking outside your head. So this is just the way evolution has figured out to put these two big pianos rolled up inside your temporal bone so that they fit. Kind of like a convolution, right? This folding allows large objects to fit into small spaces. All right, and then if this part of the organ of Corti is stimulated, it's going to send action potentials to a part of the temporal lobe. And in the temporal lobe, you have like pianos as well. Those receive, what part of the temporal lobe is going to receive these signals? On one end, or the other end, or in the middle of the temporal lobe? At least the auditory cortex. It has the exact same arrangement, right, as the organ of Corti right here. So action potentials will go to the middle part of the auditory cortex, and you'll hear like a mid-range sound, okay? Or if you hear, or if three frequencies come in, a high frequency, a mid-range, and a low frequency, guess what you're going to hear? I wish I could sing that, but you can only sing one note at a time. But on a piano, you could hit three keys, at one time to emit three frequencies, and what would that be? That would be a chord then, right? That would be a nice simple chord. Okay. All right, so what part of the ear is this? Is this external, middle, or internal? That's the internal ear, and it's the cochlea. What's the function of the cochlea? It's what special sense? It's for hearing, right? What are the receptor cells for hearing? Hair cells. And what's the name of the organ for hearing that's made up of hair cells? Yeah, the organ of Corti, but don't forget about that tectorial membrane, okay, the basilar membrane down over here, and the hair cells. All right, so that's pretty good for hearing. Okay, let's go to the next part. So here's the next part right here. So here's the cochlea for what sense again? Hearing. Here's the vestibule. And inside the vestibule, there's some fluid-filled compartments. And let's zoom in. These are called maculae, right? So there are two. There's a utricle and saccule. So here is a zoomed-in region of either one of these things. So there's like a basement membrane. And here is a cell, and it's got stereocilia on it. So guess what the name of this receptor cell is? Because it has these stereocilia on them. They're hair cells, just like what you use for hearing or what you use for hearing, right? But these stereocilia aren't attached to a tectorial membrane. They're attached to sort of like a gooey substance. It's just a gelatinous material right here. And on top of the gelatinous material are some calcium carbonate crystals. These are tiny little grains of like sand or rocks that are inside the vestibule right here. And so these act like weights that press down on the gelatinous mass and can actually bend the stereocilia. When it's pushing straight down, the stereocilia don't bend and they really don't send much in the way of interesting information to the brain when that happens. So your brain knows you're standing with your head in an erect position, standing straight up. But if you were to tilt your head forward, guess what happens? These otoliths, okay, pull the gelatinous mass and then it bends the stereocilia and that changes the electrical activity of these hair cells. And then you know if you're lying down, face down, or lying down with your head down on a pillow, okay? And so that's the sense of linear acceleration or static equilibrium. Let's see if I have it on this slide over here. Balance. All right, so static equilibrium, okay, contains the maculae. You got two of those. You got the utricle and saccule. And for static equilibrium, you've got these otoliths. What does oto mean? Oto means having to do with hearing. And lith is like a stone or something. So these are little stones inside your ear that give you the sense of, right, linear acceleration, and another name for that is static equilibrium, linear acceleration. So linear acceleration would be not just velocity. Say you're traveling 60 miles an hour and you don't change your velocity at all, these things won't respond. But if all of a sudden you start to stop, these things will tell you that you're decelerating, or if you're at a stoplight and then you punch the accelerator and you accelerate really fast, right, then these things will tell your body that you're accelerating, and then you can make compensation so you don't lose body position. That's why we call it equilibrium. So linear acceleration and static equilibrium are the same thing. The bony labyrinth is the vestibule, and the organs are the maculae. Okay, and here you got utricle and saccule. What are the receptor cells? Hair cells. Okay, so that's the second sense. The third sense also has to do with equilibrium, but we call it kinetic equilibrium. All right, a little bit different. And it's different because your body uses the semicircular canals in order to sense kinetic equilibrium. And kinetic equilibrium, let me get back over here. Kinetic equilibrium, another name for kinetic equilibrium, right, sometimes is called angular acceleration. But what's a really, that's kind of a fancy term. What's not such a fancy term for angular acceleration? What is angular motion in you? Just going straight back and forward? Angular motion is when you start to spin. Okay? So you could spin right to left. You can spin front to back. Okay? So there are three different ways that you can start to spin, and it's the semicircular canals, right, that allow you to sense which way you're spinning. But it's not just a constant velocity. It's when you start or stop spinning is when the semicircular canals here give information to your brain. So let's see how that goes. Well, here is just going back to the static equilibrium here, those otoliths. When you change your head position, you can see how the gelatinous material gets pulled down because of the otoliths, and it deforms those stereocilia right there. Okay. Four, kinetic equilibrium. In the ampule of the semicircular canals, you have an organ called the crista ampullaris. Right? So the organ is the crista ampullaris for angular acceleration or kinetic equilibrium. Let me quiz you. What's the organ for hearing called? Ah, that's a receptor cell. That's close. But the organ. An organ is what? Many cells put together. What's the organ for hearing? Organ of Corti. Right? And what structure is the organ of Corti in? The bony labyrinth. It's the cochlea. Right? Okay. So the organ for kinetic equilibrium is the crista ampullaris inside the semicircular canals. Now the receptor cells, here I see a receptor cell, and look what it has. It has kinocilium, right, so it's just a modified cilia that pokes into this gelatinous mass. This one right here does not have any otoliths on it, but it pokes up into this fluid, okay, called endolymph. And if you're standing still for a long period of time, this endolymph is not moving, right? And if you start to spin, right, then your head starts to spin with your body and it spins the semicircular canals, but this fluid inside the semicircular canal, it really isn't attached to anything, it's just a fluid and it can flow around in a nice circle if it wants to. And one of the properties of matter is that it has inertia. And inertia just means that if you have mass that's stationary, it wants to stay stationary. It takes a lot of force to get it to move. Right, but it also means that if you have a mass that's in motion and then you remove the force from it, what does that mass like to do? It likes to stay in motion. So that's a property of inertia. So when your head starts to spin, this endolymph, because of inertia, likes to stay stationary, but now you're moving this gelatinous mass right here called the cupula. Right? And then that endolymph is going to flow over the cupula, and when it does, it's going to bend the cupula, which is going to bend the kinocilium, and that's going to send to your brain a sense of spinning. Yeah. Maybe. I want to go over the mechanism of this, and it probably will relate to your question. Okay. Sometimes we elicit that kind of that sense of equilibrium by spinning around. Okay, so let's go over that scenario. All right, so if you're standing still, endolymph isn't moving. When you start to move, the endolymph doesn't want to move and it's going to press up against the cochlea, which starts to move. And let's just say now you've been spinning for a long period of time, like your kids at home, or you still do, maybe even last night. Okay, and then all of a sudden you stop. What sense do you have? When you look out in the room, what sense do you have? The room is spinning, okay? Well, we said that this endolymph initially doesn't want to move, but after you spin for a long period of time, it catches up with the rest of your ear and starts to spin with the same spin that you're spinning at, and then you stop, so the crista ampullaris stops, but what about this endolymph right here? It's still spinning, so it pushes on the cupula the other way, right? And its job is to measure spinning, so it's sending information to your brain that you're spinning because these hair cells are being deformed even though you're standing still. So that when you look at your surroundings, right, it kind of looks like it's spinning because it's getting information from the crista ampullaris saying that you're spinning, but that's only under those weird circumstances. So, what is it when people have a sense maybe that they're spinning, an inappropriate sense of spinning? Well, that could be due to maybe a little bit of an inflammation of the inner ear right here. Could be due to what? Adult beverage, which kind of toxifies these nerve endings right here. Okay, maybe other kinds of drugs. Maybe other kinds of stimuli, like maybe cold, for instance, can stimulate these nerves. Maybe, for instance, if people go surfing a lot, it can damage or make this part of the auditory system or otic system kind of inflamed. Okay, and any kind of inflammation of the inner ear right here is called a labyrinthitis, right? Which then will give you some inappropriate sense of spinning. I don't know if there's any treatment for that, because usually it's a viral infection and you can't take any drugs for viral infections, right? Other ways that you can become dizzy is if you're in a car that's traveling really fast on a windy road, can stimulate this part and can give you a sense of motion sickness. So sometimes when people have disequilibrium, a sense of spinning, they might be nauseated as well, okay? But it's due to inflammation of this inner part of the ear. Maybe certain medications can make it worse. So there's a whole bunch of reasons. It's really hard to know which one it is. So a clinician could help figure that out over time. All right, so what is the receptor cell for hearing? Hair cell. What's the receptor cell for static equilibrium? A hair cell. What's the receptor cell for kinetic equilibrium? That's a hair cell, once again, but just applied, right, to different structures inside the petrous region of the temporal bone. And so you change the structure, what can you change? You can change the function of those particular organs. So, I don't know, it's kind of fascinating that the exact same cell can give your body three totally different kinds of sensations. Okay, one last thing. What's the organ for hearing? The organ for hearing in the cochlea is the organ of Corti. What's the organ for static equilibrium? It's the maculae, and you could call those the utricle and saccule. And what's the organ for kinetic equilibrium? The crista ampullaris right here, right? Because it's in the ampule of the semicircular canals. Right, so don't forget, because it's a nice semicircular canal, this fluid can actually flow in a nice circle all the way around. Right, and when you turn in a circle, what do we call that? That's spinning, that's just spinning, right? Or angular acceleration. All right, so lastly, what do I want to make sure we go over? Linear acceleration is the same as what sense? The sense of linear acceleration is the same as static equilibrium, and angular acceleration is the same as, here's angular acceleration, that's the same as kinetic equilibrium, okay? And kinetic equilibrium is what? Just a sense of spinning. What else do I have on here? Ah, that's it. Yay, that's it for senses. All right, so make sure you know the difference between general sense and special sense. And we still have some time left over, which is fantastic. So what should we do next according to the schedule? Okay, we've done endocrinology already. So we're going to go to the heart. Okay, so, I got to pull up the other lecture notes. Heart, where's heart? Heart, cardiac. Okay, size, location, shape. Okay, so here's a picture of somebody's heart. What cavity is it in? Ah, trick question. You're right, thoracic cavity. But it's also in, what, the ventral cavity. But what's the small cavity that it's in? Yeah, the pericardial cavity, right? And there's a special membrane that surrounds the pericardial. It's called the pericardial cavity. It's a serous membrane, which means it has three parts that we're going to talk about. I can see the pericardium right here that suspends the heart, keep it from moving around too much. Okay? The heart is about as big as your fist. That's about the size of it. And this is an interesting organ in the sense that in this class, we have really looked at the symmetry of your body. We haven't looked at the asymmetry. And we call this bilateral symmetry. So if you have a hand on one side of your body, what do you got on the other? You got a hand on the other side. If you got a femur on one side, what do you got on the other? You got a femur on the other side. But the heart is a little bit different. It's not right smack in the middle of your body. It's over to one side. What side is it mostly on? It's mostly on the left, right? Because you know that from watching a bunch of movies. And when you look at this heart right here, you should think of it as a triangle or a pyramid, right? And you can see that the heart is angulated. As you go from superior to inferior, the angulation, well, let me tell you, what the broad part of the heart, the superior part is called the base, and the tip narrow part down over here is what we call the, okay? So you can think of a triangle from geometry. What do you call the tip of a triangle? Or the tip of a pyramid, that's the apex of the pyramid. So here's the apex down over here, here's the base. It's just upside down. So as you go from base to apex, how do you move? So here's the heart, here's the base, here's the apex. It's not right smack in the middle of your chest. As you go from base to apex, which way does it move? Over to the left. That's one angulation, but there's another angulation as well. As you go from base to apex, it also moves anteriorly. So it's doubly angulated. So if you want a really clear picture of the heart, you need to doubly angulate that particular MRI scan to do that. So that's sort of interesting. You got to angulate it to the left, and you got to angulate it anteriorly like that to get a nice longitudinal section of it, right? And it's beating. So the heart's beating. What part of the heart is hitting your chest wall all the time? So when it beats, it goes like that. So it's the apex that's actually pounding up against your thoracic cage, and you can feel that point pretty easily. You can palpate kind of underneath your pectoralis muscle. It's a little bit different in everybody's body, okay? Maybe changes a little bit with body position. But that's a good landmark to find out where your heart is right inside your chest. Like if you're going to do an imaging study or put electrodes on somebody to do an ECG, you can always get an idea where their heart is. So don't forget, the heart angles, and it angles over what? To the left. That's why most of it is over on the left side. That point that's beating up against your chest wall is what we call the point of maximal impulse. And on really thin people, you can see it just like bulge out on their chest wall pretty easily. And usually we don't say point of maximal impulse. What do we just say? What do we just say? It's here on your list. It's called the PMI. All right, so that's the biaxial tilt. Okay, pericardium on the heart. So that's the fibrous connective tissue that surrounds the heart. Let's see what we got right here. Rats, I have to sneeze. Sorry about that. Are we still here? Yeah, mostly everything is still here. Good. Okay, so here is a cross-section on the top of the heart. And here is, okay, so we're going to talk about the connective tissue on the outside of the heart. There is a fibrous pericardium that's really tough. What does that kind of remind you of? Do you remember looking at a membrane on the surface of something that was really tough? And what was it called? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the dura mater. You had to cut through that to get to the brain, right? The dura mater. Okay, so the fibrous pericardium. And then I see the parietal division of the pericardium. And then here's the pericardial cavity with pericardial fluid. Pericardial fluid is just a special name for serous fluid that surrounds the heart, so that absorbs a lot of shock when the heart is pounding. It helps float the heart so that it's not so heavy. Right? And the parietal layer, right, curves around and then lies right on the surface of the heart. And we call that, right, the visceral pericardium. So parietal is on the wall of the cavity. The visceral is right on the surface of the heart. And the visceral pericardium has another name. Since it sits right on top of the heart, sometimes it's called the epicardium. So epicardium and visceral pericardium are the same thing. Right, so this is a nice serous membrane because what are the three parts of a serous membrane? You've got a parietal, right, and then a visceral division, and what separates those two membranes? The serous fluid right here. And you can get an inflammation or an infection of this area. That's called pericarditis. And then fluid builds up in this region, right, all the way around the heart. So instead of being maybe about 1 centimeter, it could be 2, 3, maybe 4, 5 centimeters in thickness filled up with fluid. Guess what happens to the size of the heart when this pericardial cavity fills up with fluid? It might be inflammation due to maybe surgery or who knows why. What happens if you fill this space up with fluid, okay, this fibrous pericardium doesn't change shape, so it can't expand. Guess what happens to the heart? It gets compressed. It starts to shrink, all right? And maybe it can contract just perfectly, but what does the heart have to do before when it contracts before it can pump blood? It's got to relax and fill with blood, and if the heart's contracted, blood can't even get into the heart so that when the heart contracts, it's not pumping blood. All right, so I suppose you could imagine what that's like. What would that be like? If the heart is pumping maybe strongly, but it's not pumping blood because all of this fluid here in the pericardial cavity, called the pericardial effusion, what's that? That is bad because then you're not pumping blood to your body, right? Okay. So how do you get rid of this fluid right here? You got to do it in a hurry because this guy's heart isn't pumping any blood. Hypodermic needle, jab it in there, aspirate that fluid out. And you might think that's gruesome, but if you had that pericardial effusion, you'd be feeling miserable. And then seconds later, even though you got jabbed in the chest with that needle, guess what? You'd have a smile on your face and you'd be thanking the physician, right? Because it's really good to have your heart pumping blood. All right, so that's the serous membrane. Okay. Now, as far as layers of the heart proper, since we're on this slide, I'm going to talk about it right now. One is part of the pericardial membrane, right? But we're just going to look at the heart wall itself. The membrane that's right on the surface of the heart, we call that the epicardium. That's also known as what? The visceral layer of the pericardium. And then the part of the heart that's made up of muscle tissue is called the myocardium. And then there's another layer that should remind you of bones. Right, there's another layer that lines every interior space inside the heart, and that's called the endocardium. And the endocardium, right, is really smooth and slippery so that blood flows over it. And another reason is because when blood flows over a rough, jagged surface, guess what it likes to do? It likes to turn from a nice fluid into a solid. We call that coagulation, or forms a blood clot. And then that's really bad because that blood clot can then stop blood flow to the heart, causing a heart attack, or forms a clot going to the brain that causes a stroke, or maybe to the lungs, okay, that's going to kill part of the lungs. That would be a pulmonary embolism. And, of course, you know people die from these things frequently, right? But the endocardium reduces that risk of forming blood clots inside the heart and also in all of the blood vessels. All right, chambers inside the heart. The question you got to ask yourself is, how many chambers does the heart have? And we're going to look at this example right here. Okay, there are 4 chambers. All right, there are 2 inferior chambers that are surrounded by big, thick walls, muscle walls. These are the ventricles. These are the major pumps of the heart. There's a right ventricle and a left ventricle. So how many sides does the heart have? I see 2 ventricles right here. So what I want you to see is that there's a right side of the heart and a left side, okay? And then superior to the ventricles are the atria. Here's the right atrium and left atrium, right? And again, that just kind of underscores that the heart has a right side and a left side. All right, so what is the job of the heart? What is it supposed to do? It's supposed to pump blood, right? So it contracts. And blood should only flow in one direction through the heart. And so there are things that prevent the backward flow of blood. That backward flow is what we call retrograde flow. So I want to use that term from now on, retrograde flow. The forward flow is called anterograde. Those are the proper terms. So there are structures inside the heart that prevent retrograde flow. And could anybody guess what structures in the heart prevent backward flow or retrograde flow? Valves. That's right. So how many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
Two superior, two inferior. There's four. How many valves does the heart have? And you should just yell that answer out too, because it's the same number. There are four. All right, four chambers, four valves. Now you just have to know where these valves are, what their names are. All right, so when the atrium contracts, it pushes blood into the ventricle, in this particular case on the right side. Right? And then the ventricle is going to contract, so the blood will have a tendency to move back from the ventricle back up into the atrium, the right atrium right here. Well, what will that be like? That's going to be terrible. Have any of you tried to walk up or run up a sand dunes? What's that like? It's really fun, right? Because you get halfway up and what do you feel like? You feel like puking. You feel like you're just going to croak because it's so much work. You take one step up, right, and you slide back down half a step. And then you take another step up. So it takes you all day, right, to get up there. So if this valve was leaking blood from the ventricle back into the atria, that would be like this poor heart running up a sand dunes all the time. It's pumping some blood in the right direction, but it slips backwards. All right, but not just for the 5 minutes that you're walking up the sand dune. It would be what? For 24 hours a day, right? Years at a time, that eventually is going to kill the heart. Just like if you had to do that for 10 years, walk up a sand dunes, I'm sure, you know, none of us could even make it 10 years doing that. All right, so that valve has to be repaired or replaced. So this valve prevents retrograde flow. This valve is between an atrium and a ventricle. So in anatomy, we can take two words and put them together, as long as we do what to that word, those two words? Put an O between them. So here is an atrioventricular valve, right? Atrioventricular valve. On what side of the heart is this? This is the right side. And the atrioventricular valve on the right side is called the tricuspid valve, because these little leaflets that flap back and forth together, sometimes we call these little cusps. And this valve has three of them that come together, hence it's called the tricuspid. So tricuspid, you got to remember, is on the right side of the heart. Here is another atrioventricular valve, right? We see blood can flow down this direction, but not retrograde. What side of the heart is this on? This is the left side. And this valve right here only has two leaflets or two cusps. So we call this the bicuspid valve on the left side. And it also has another name. Sometimes it's called the mitral valve because it reminded somebody of a fancy hat that people wear when they're saying mass, especially high masses, right? That they stick on their heads like this, a nice bright red one or gold one if you're the Pope. Okay, they call that a mitre. Two flaps right here. All right, so those are atrioventricular valves. Where do you find atrioventricular valves? Between where and where? Between an atrium and a ventricle, and it prevents blood from going from a ventricle into this atrium right here. All right, now when the ventricles contract, since blood normally can't go into an atrium, it goes out an artery. Here I see an artery. This is a pulmonary artery. This first little part of it is called the pulmonary trunk. So the ventricles pump blood into the pulmonary trunk or the aorta that I see a little bit behind it. And then when the ventricle relaxes, blood is going to want to flow back into the ventricles, but can it? Because why? What's stopping it? Two more valves. Since this is the pulmonary trunk, we call this the pulmonary semilunar valve. And this one right here is the aortic semilunar valve, right at the root of the aorta and right at the root of the pulmonary trunk. And these valves right here have three cusps, and they're called semilunar valves because if you look at them, it looks like half of a moon. I guess these guys like to do a lot of astronomy at the same time. Okay. Which probably tells me a little bit about their origin. Who are the astronomers way back when? Yeah. I think it was those Arabs back there really loved astronomy. Right? They named all the stars, they worked out calendars and all kinds of stuff. Right? So there's a lot of Arabic for sure in this class. Right? Semilunar valves. Where else? Satellite cells. Probably same folks. Okay. Okay. Here is some tissue between the ventricles, right and left ventricle. Right? What is that wall between your nostrils called? Nasal septum. So a septum is a wall between these cavities. So here's the interventricular septum. There's also an interatrial septum that I can't quite see on this diagram right here. Right, but that's just the wall between the chambers. Let's see what else. What's the function of the chamber? What's the function of an atrium? It's to pump blood into the ventricles. What's the job of a ventricle? To pump blood into these arteries right here. Okay, so those are the four valves. We talked about the transmural layers of the heart already. Blood flow through the heart. Okay, let's look at, I tell you what, before we do that, let's look at some other little fine structures. Okay, when the ventricles contract, it pressurizes a lot of blood. These little leaflets would flap and flop back up into the atria, and they would leak. But there's something holding them so that they come together instead of inverting. And can you see these little tendons right here? They're called chordae tendineae. And chordae tendineae on one side is attached to a valve leaflet. On the other end, they're attached to little muscles inside the ventricles that we call papillary muscles. They look like little fingertips. Okay, so what kind of chambers have papillary muscles? Only the ventricles, not up in the atria, because I only see chordae tendineae down here in the ventricles. I see other muscles in the ventricles right here. These are what we call trabeculae carnae, little ridges of muscle that produce tension for contraction. But these don't have chordae tendineae on them, so they can't be papillary muscles. So hence, they're called trabeculae carnae, right? So these are called trabeculae. There are other little muscles in the atria, and again, they don't have chordae tendineae on them, right? These are what we call pectinate muscles, pectinate muscle. Pectinate in atria, trabeculae in the ventricles, and papillary muscles in the ventricles. Now, what I see on this diagram, which is pretty interesting, is let's look at the wall thickness of a left ventricle compared to the wall thickness of the right ventricle. Can you see that one is thicker than the other? Or am I making that up? Which one's thicker? The left ventricle. And indeed, that's the case. The left ventricle has to pump a lot harder, produce a lot more pressure compared to the right ventricle. And that will always be a really nice test for you in lab as a check to make sure you know which ventricle is which, because the left ventricle is always going to have a really thick wall. A right ventricle is going to be really thin. So let's take a look and see why that is. And we're going to look at this diagram right here, because we're going to talk about circulation on the heart. All right, so how many sides of the, how many chambers are there? How many valves are there? You all got to say that before you can go home. How many chambers are there? Four. How many valves are there? Now you just got to know which way is which. All right, how many sides does the heart have? Two. There's a right and a left side. So you're looking at this heart right here just like you're looking at my heart. Right, so my heart, this is my left, here's my right over here. Okay. The left ventricle pumps blood into the aorta, which goes to this happy person right here. Right? We call that the systemic circulation. It goes to almost everywhere in your body, bringing oxygen and nutrients. So this red signifies relatively high oxygen, relatively poor carbon dioxide concentration in this blood. And all the tissues in your body then absorb that oxygen, use it to make ATP, and in the process it produces a lot of CO2, right? That CO2 then gets put into, it diffuses into, actually is a better way of saying that, diffuses into the blood, and it's carried back to the heart. Okay, let's go over the definition of three kinds of blood vessels. Here's a blood vessel, and I see arrows. Which way is blood flowing through this particular blood vessel? Which is the aorta, by any? Which way is blood flowing? It's flowing away from the heart. Yeah, away from the heart. All right, so the antegrade flow would be away from the heart. And here's a definition. Listen to this lecture, I don't know, maybe 20 times, or write it down 20 times, because it's so simple, people just don't believe how simple it is. Any kind of blood vessel that carries blood away from the heart is called an artery. That's an artery. And it doesn't matter what it's carrying, doesn't matter what color it is. It's an artery. All right. Capillaries, these small blood vessels right here, are special. They don't carry blood away from the heart or to the heart. They're there for exchange. They allow for exchange of gases in and out of the blood, an exchange of metabolites in and out of the blood. And as a matter of fact, that's the only place where things can enter or leave the blood is in a capillary. Arteries are way too thick. Things can't enter or leave. Okay, only through capillaries. And then here is another blood vessel, and I see the arrow is in which direction? It's bringing blood toward the heart. And again, this is another one. It's so easy, people just don't believe it, right? That is the definition of a vein. Any kind of blood vessel that brings blood back to the heart is a vein. This particular vein is called the vena cava. Here's the superior vena cava. Here's the inferior vena cava. In lab, you'll see where these are in a little bit more detail. All right, so this circulation from the left ventricle, then ending up back in the right atrium, is what we call the systemic circuit, delivering blood to almost everywhere, and nutrients and oxygen everywhere to your body. So blue signifies what? Does it signify this is an artery? Does it signify it's a vein? No. It signifies that it's deoxygenated blood. What signifies that this is a vein? Not the color, it's the direction of the arrow only, direction of the arrow. All right, so that's one side of the heart. That's the left side of the heart. Let's look at the right side. Here is the right ventricle pumping blood into what we call the pulmonary artery, and this is going to take blood from a ventricle to the, what do we got right here? What are these little jobbers right here? Those are your lungs. Okay, so here is a blood vessel that's carrying blood toward the lungs. Is this a artery or a vein? Look at that arrow. Is it the same as this arrow right here? Or are these arrows different? Is this arrow different than this one? Well, they look white to me. What's the direction? Same direction, away from the heart. So this is an artery, you already agree with, and so this has got to be an artery as well. Okay? But it's the pulmonary artery. And the pulmonary artery, should that be high in oxygen or low in oxygen? It should be low in oxygen, right? Because it's going to the lungs to pick up oxygen, right? There are capillaries in the lungs right here that let CO2 leave and oxygen enter. That's what we call exchange. So these capillaries are important for exchange. In this particular case, it's the opposite compared to the systemic capillaries. In the pulmonary capillaries, oxygen enters and CO2 leaves. So what about this blood going back to the heart from the lungs? Is this an artery or a vein? It's a vein because it's bringing blood back to the heart, but is it high in oxygen or high in CO2? It's high in oxygen because it's coming back from the lungs. So this is what we call the pulmonary circuit, and you should notice that the pulmonary circuit is opposite compared to the systemic circuit in terms of the contents that it's carrying, in terms of oxygen and CO2. And when you get to physiology, you'll see that it's going to be opposite in some other senses as well, other concepts. Okay? All right, so a vein brings blood back to the heart. Doesn't matter what color it is. Give me the name of a vein that's carrying deoxygenated blood. The vena cava, right? Superior and inferior vena cava. Give me the name of a vein that's carrying oxygenated blood. The pulmonary vein. Okay, so you just got to rely on those definitions. What's an artery? What's a vein? And it's just a very simple, basic definition. Away from the heart is an artery. Toward the heart is a vein. Okay. Okay, so coronary circulation. You got two main coronaries, and they come off, I tell you what, let's go back and look at a couple blood vessels on the heart. This is probably a pretty good one to start to look at. Okay, this most anterior vessel, this is the pulmonary artery that's connected to the right ventricle. It's taking blood away to the heart, and where is it going to go? Where is this blood going to go? Since it's the pulmonary trunk and that bifurcates in these pulmonary arteries, taking blood away from the heart to the lungs, right? And so it's relatively high in CO2. That's why it's a blue color, even though it's an artery. Okay, and then it goes to the lungs, and then blood comes back from the lungs via what?
pulmonary veins, and these are red colored because now that blood is high in oxygen. These pulmonary veins empty into the left atrium. The left atrium pumps blood into the left ventricle. Left ventricle pumps blood into the aorta, which then supplies blood to your whole body. That's the first part of the systemic circulation. And I see some branches on the arch of the aorta. This first one is a brachiocephalic. It's taking blood to an arm and to the head on the left side of the body. And then these next two are doing the job of the brachiocephalic over here. So this is what we call a common carotid. Takes blood to the right side of the head. And here is, left common carotid. And then here is the left subclavian. And what bone does that go right underneath? The clavicle, right? And so that's going to take blood to the left arm. So brachiocephalic. Brachiocephalic is going to bifurcate very shortly, very soon, to a right common carotid and a right subclavian, which is what these two over here are doing. Okay. All right, then blood goes to your body, comes back via the vena cava, which just means big cavernous vein. Here's the inferior one. Here's the superior one. Both of these empty blood into the right atrium. And the right atrium pumps blood into the right ventricle, and the right ventricle back into the pulmonary trunk or pulmonary arteries, which goes to the lungs. So that's pretty much the whole circulation. Okay, so here's a trick question. And I'll preface it a little bit. Here's the ascending aorta. Here's the arch of the aorta. And then there's going to be a descending part that's behind the heart that goes down through your thoracic cavity into your abdominal cavity. And here's a nasty trick question. What's the first branch off the aorta? What's the first branch? Okay, what's the first branch? And on this diagram, I see brachiocephalic. Okay, and I would agree with you. It's the first branch off the arch of the aorta. But don't forget, there's a little bit of the ascending aorta right here, and there are two important blood vessels that branch off the ascending aorta, and those are arteries that actually bring blood to the heart. And blood vessels that bring blood to the heart are called coronary blood vessels, coronary arteries, coronary veins, and there are two. Here is a coronary. Here's a main coronary that brings blood to what side of the heart is this over here? That's the right side, so that's the right coronary artery. And then here's another coronary that's coming from the ascending aorta right here. This is what we call the left coronary artery. So the right and left coronary arteries bring blood to the whole heart. The left coronary bifurcates very early on into a circumflex that goes to the posterior side of the heart. And then the other branch goes all the way down toward the apex of the heart, through a depression in the heart between the right and left ventricles that we call the interventricular sulcus, or sometimes anterior longitudinal sulcus. And this is what we call, commonly in hospitals, we call this the left anterior descending. This is the one that has a lot of pathology in it. Unfortunately, it goes to the left side of the heart, which is the strongest side, which is the side that needs the most oxygen. It's the left side, and this is the one that gets the most damage, unfortunately. That's why cardiovascular disease is so critical to take care of. All right? Left anterior descending, but sometimes it's also called the interventricular artery, anterior interventricular, because it lies right on that interventricular septum between the right and left ventricles right here. Okay. On the posterior side of the heart, so I flip the heart around. Here are veins that are bringing coronary veins that bring blood back to the heart, and in particular the right atrium. And this is the great cardiac vein, and it leads to the cardiac sinus. This is just a big, huge vein, and then the coronary sinus dumps blood into the right atrium, along with the superior vena cava and inferior vena cava right here. All right, so in lab, fortunately, you get to play around with these structures quite a bit. Before we go, I just want to talk a little bit about the fibrous skeleton of the heart. That will help us a bunch. All right, so I need to go back to this slide. So think of this right here as being the base of the heart. Here's the apex. Okay, the atria are above that plane, the ventricles are below it, and there's some fibrous connective tissue that makes like a wall between the atria and the ventricle. So there's a hole, there are valves right through that wall, and that's called the fibrous myocardium, and this is what it looks like, right? So right in this plane right here. So here is the fibrous myocardium, and it doesn't contain muscle tissue. It just contains a lot of collagen and other kinds of connective tissue, so it's really, really tough. So this is where the rings of the valves, the roots of the valves are attached, because there's a lot of force applied to these valves right here, and they would rip out of the heart, but they're attached to the fibrous myocardium, right, that holds them in place. So if somebody needs a heart valve replaced, guess what? It's not too terrible of a job, because guess what you get to sew that valve into? Not the heart muscle, which is relatively weak, which those sutures can rip out, but this stuff right here is even tougher than the dermis of your skin. It has even more collagen fiber, so it's pretty easy to sew in a replacement valve in these locations right here. All right, so it anchors the valve cusps, and since it's really tough, it prevents these valves from dilating. What would happen to the efficiency of these valves if all of a sudden the root of this valve right here, or the aorta, started to expand? Then the leaflets won't touch each other, they'll just flip back and forth, and then it will cease to act like a valve. So this fibrous myocardium keeps the shape of the valve, it maintains the integrity of the shape of the valve so that it doesn't expand, and then you don't need a valve replacement when that happens. All right. But also, muscles need origins and insertions, right, in order to work properly. So this fibrous myocardium right here acts as a nice insertion for the muscle of the heart so that it contracts properly. And then the last thing, which we're going to talk about next time, there is special electrical system within the heart, right? And that electrical system from the atria is separated from the ventricles because those electrical signals can't get through the fibrous myocardium except for one little place. So that means that the atria can contract first before the ventricles, and does that make sense? Because what's the job of the atria here? To pump blood into the ventricles so that when they contract, they have blood to pump. So the atria should contract first, followed by the ventricles. So there's a special coordination system that makes sure that that happens, right? And then we call that the conduction system of the heart, and that's where we're going to start next time. And I think that's the last part of this particular chapter. All right, so please, I got to get up to lab really quick. I know I like to talk to students after lecture sometimes, but I've been getting late to lab. So everybody, please get your books together and so I can lock the room up so somebody doesn't spray paint our nice screens that we have right here. Sign-in sheet went around someplace, so bring that sign-in sheet down. Here it is right here. Thank you. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got to turn these microphones off. Yes, go ahead and sign that.
I'll have to email it to you because I don't have it memorized.